Spruik, also known as Bill Bolden. I'm a internet DJ and producer. I'm best known for my podcast Bump in the Night, which is a weekly electro house and big room dance music podcast. It's been running without interruption for over 3 years. I'm also known for having produced The Gathering with Patrick Chapin. But I'm here today to talk about my new Kickstarter, Music to Die Alone in Space 2.
So about this project, What makes it so different compared to your previous work?
I mean, it's really a whole new paradigm, I think, that's sort of unprecedented just in the digital distribution model. I've been a producer for a long time, but I've always just produced music the same way everyone always has, by creating songs that exist in one copy. And this is an attempt to do something more artistic. Lots of artists have explored the idea of non-deterministic music, so music that doesn't exist as a single sound file, but as a set of rules. But I believe I'm the first person to take it all the way to the idea that I'm going to make an entire album release where everybody who buys the album gets a different copy. They can, when they, you know, turn this one on in their iTunes, they'll be hearing a set of sounds that belongs to only them. And I think that's going to be a really cool, intimate thing to share with all the listeners, is sort of feeling like, wow, this is sort of my sound of it and no one else's.
Yeah, it's something I mentioned before to you when we were talking about it. It seems like this type of project is perfect for Kickstarter and the way crowdfunding is, you know, works nowadays.
That's actually interesting. You should say that. I'm a member of a Kickstarter group. So there's a private Facebook group where we discuss Kickstarter best practices. And when I posted this there for constructive criticism, a couple people said to me, "This doesn't look at all like you want to do a Kickstarter for it. It's too unusual. It's too formless. Like, Kickstarter is for making board games and video game pre-production, and you just kind of crank this stuff out on a mill." And there's a couple other people in the thread who are like, I disagree. I'm sick of people using Kickstarter to just make the next handbag that's obviously going to fund because it's a pretty handbag. This is the kind of bold idea that the whole idea of Kickstarter is like, whoa, I need to see if I can get people on board with this so I can take this plunge. They're like, this is like what a Kickstarter should be all about. And fortunately right now, I think that since I'm funded for 2.5 times my desired amount 4 days in, I think that maybe I hit the right nerve instead of the wrong one.
It kind of gives people that initial feeling of like sort of exclusivity and individuality. I think it really kind of gets to what Kickstarter is really about.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that go on here. You know, one is there's been a lot of people asking for a long time, how do you bring scarcity back for part of the musical experience? How do you ever replicate the feeling that sometimes a collector once got to feel when they obtained a rare release on vinyl, and it was rare because only 400 of it were ever produced? And you had that physical limitation, but you just don't get that with music anymore. And this is one way of looking at it is, well, your copy, only yours might have, let's say, track 10 of the album is called Oblivion. Maybe your copy is the only one where at the 3-minute mark, Oblivion just goes, oh, and has this crazy moment that happens on your copy and nobody else's. And that's something that I don't think you can get in any other musical project right now. And then I do just agree that Kickstarter is the right place for something like this because it helps gender the excitement, engender the excitement coming into this where we're all sort of in this forum together, me and the backers are messaging me sometimes saying, like, I don't even know what to expect. Like, I can't wait for my copy. What is this going to be like? Yeah. And I'm responding, I don't even know what it's going to be like either. I don't know what this is going to sound like yet. I have a vague idea because I wrote the whole album. But when I hear your copy as it's being recorded, it'll be a surprise to me too.
So could you walk us a little bit through the process? So right now you currently have everything written out. And how is the execution being done?
Yeah, so I've got 10 tracks so far. I'm trying to see if I can't get one or two more, but I may have written all I have to write, so to speak. Like, I'm looking at the 10 tracks I have, and I feel like I've made my artistic statement. I'm trying to see if I can work on one more. But so each track is a project. I use the software Sonar X3 Producer in conjunction with the Sonar Propeller Head Reason. I've been using them both for almost 20 years. I love these programs. And the projects in them, which normally they're just track song material, well, in this case, they're really a whole lot of program synths, which have been routed in such a way so as to be unpredictable in their output. There's a lot of random things going on, a lot of things that don't come out the same way, so that when I play one of the tracks, it sounds one way. I rewind to the beginning and hit play again, it sounds different. So now to create the album, I'm going to look at how many total ones I'm creating. Something like, at this rate, I don't know if I can maintain the growth of the first few days of this Kickstarter over all 22 days of it, but it looks like I may be recording, at a conservative estimate, maybe 200 copies of this album. I'm taking notes of the voiceover artists people want and sitting down and saying, all right, first things first, it's time to record 200 adrifts, 10 of which will have no voiceover, 63 of which will have the British woman voiceover, 42 of which will have the Hindi woman voiceover, 60 of which will have the gruff Midwestern male voiceover, etc., and just start, turn the master recorder on, hit play, label that render one of adrift, hit play, label that render two, and at a healthy pace, going through, you know, saying the track is 5 or 6 minutes long, that I could probably clear 50 to 60 copies of it a night. I could probably do 10 an hour, and I could work for 5 or 6 hours an evening. So I'll probably just be spending an entire week's work just exporting all 200 adrifts. And then next week, maybe I'm working on all 200 neutrinoses, etc. And then for the big finish at the end, we'll be giving John Doe his copy. I'll just be picking, all right, John Doe, your copy's going to have adrift number 215, refractions number 32, neutrinos number 111. Compile that all together, put it all in one big master project, and re-export it as a master file so that all the tracks overlap and the tail end of one can influence the beginning of another. And then finally take that big file, split it out to tracks, and that's one person's copy. All in all, it's probably going to be about 2 hours of work per copy, as long as I'm doing them all assembly line style. It's going to be a lot of work. I'm very excited, and I really believe in the music, which is why I think I can maybe bear to hear it 200 times per track.
Yeah. Since you've reached your goal multiple times over already, are you a little scared that this might get a little too out of hand? I mean, are you prepared to, like, scale up if things get kind of crazy?
I have contingency plans. I would say that with my present infrastructure, I'm prepared to export, I think, up to 200 of these on my present time scale. If I get beyond 200 and I start to approach 500, I probably have to add 2 months onto everyone's deliverables. If I get very far past 500, that would be a very good problem to have. There's probably a point at which I have to tell people that orders are closing. I hope it doesn't come to that, but there's really, like I said, at 2 hours of work per copy, well, for instance, there's a, you know, an American work year is 4,000 hours. So I can't really sell 2,000 copies of these unless I'm prepared to make it my full-time job for an entire year making them. So, you know, the ceiling is probably somewhere around there. I don't really want to have to think about it till I get there. If it starts to get like that, I may look into I have other synth friends who can help export these for me. I can pay people, set up around-the-clock mill, just cranking out renders. I mean, necessity is the mother of invention.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I'm only bringing that up because, you know, what's going to happen now are people who are just going to discover this project and go, oh, cool, it's already funded, so no matter what, I'm going to get this. And then it's just going to avalanche like that, you know. There's that potential there.
Yeah, there was fortunately a lull today from the national holiday.
Yeah.
I stopped picking up backers just for Labor Day. I think everyone's at barbecues.
Right,
but
right.
After some press comes out tomorrow, I don't know when this goes up, so I shouldn't use phrases like today and tomorrow. But depending on when this goes up, I think when the work week hits, it's going to be full steam ahead. Like I said, I'm fully capable of – I'm comfortable outputting up to about 200 of these. And even past that, I'm still doing it. I'm just pushing everyone's estimates on delivery a little back.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's uncharted waters, right? When you're trying to write new rules, chart new territory, you have to figure out what works as you go. And this whole voiceover selection thing is kind of a new beast too, that I've sort of had to work out how that's going to work as things are coming along. So one of the draws is that I want to offer people as wide of a range of identities on this album so that something can resonate with them, right? Because like I say in the Kickstarter video, if this is a Hollywood product, then when they're making this story about an astronaut who's dying alone in space, they would just pick gruff Midwestern male, and here I am, floating alone in space. And that'd be right. The copy everyone gets. We've seen it over and over again in all the movies. But I don't believe in that. I believe, you know, that given how many nations participate in space travel, it's likely to be anybody. And I think that I really wanted this to resonate with each listener. So, for instance, I had one backer send me a message saying, you know, I'm an American, but I was born and raised in Mexico, and this will resonate with me and feel like it's me if a Mexican-accented man is speaking in mostly English, mixing in some Spanish. And it's like, I want to make that happen. So I'm taking everyone's suggestions and compiling this big list. It's up to 20 suggestions already.
Wow.
We're going to run a poll at the close of the Kickstarter saying, everyone, we got to narrow this list down to 12 people I can hire. Because at this rate, you know, there will be 80 suggestions, and I can't hire voice actors, 80 voice actors. Which 12 will we go with? And just try and make sure that I hit as many different languages and identities as possible so that no one feels left out, right? So that no matter what your place in this world is or who you feel like you are, there's at least one voice that speaks to you in the language or style you feel most comfortable with.
Yeah, that's nice. That's cool.
Yeah, it's coming along well. That's, like I said, it's going to be hard making those cuts. I hope to satisfy everybody. And, of course, a lot of people just want no voiceover on their copy because they the sound of the album is so deep and pensive and like soundtrack music that they don't want the distraction of a voice at all. And that's their right, you know, on their copy.
Yeah. So let's talk about the soundscape a little bit. What was your influence on your decision to, I guess, have this concept? Where did that come from?
You know, it came from a couple places. There's a few things going on. One is that I've been looking for a while to limit my palette because they say restrictions breed creativity. And at the point where I'm at in my progression as a producer, I'm at the point where I can kind of make anything I want and do a decent job. And so there's sort of this paralyzing thing when you sit down to write. And it's like, do I want to write something that's like a clone of Call Me Maybe? Or do I want to make a dubstep track? Or do I want to write an acoustic ballad? And it's like, I don't know, like, provide me some direction. And so deliberately restricting my palette that I can paint with is very important. It gives me a reason to tie songs together instead of just making disjointed singles. And I have my whole life been fascinated with music that gets very gentle, music that just sort of dwindles away. There's been a couple big songs in my life that have influenced me in that regard. There's parts of the Massive Attack album, 1000th Window, especially in tracks like Small Time Shot Away or what's the other one I really like? Not Anti-Star, but Future Proof, where the music just gets so gentle, it's kind of like you could just die to it. And there's points in sometimes Phish's discography, because I actually listen to a lot of Phish, which would surprise people. Hmm. When Kanye wrote 808s and Heartbreak, he took such a patient approach with some of the tracks. Like, for instance, the end of Love Lockdown or Bad News, opening track, Don't Say You Will, where the track just takes about 4 minutes to end of just running through the same loop. And it's like, why? Because I can, because I have the time. And that's how I sort of felt coming into this is, you know what? I'm trying to paint this story of this astronaut. He's got an hour, but he's in no hurry because what's going to happen? So if I'm telling a story where we're going to start hearing like the interplay of like a heartbeat and a breath while the suit is beeping a little in one ear, and over that is a melody that's coming from like the melody is coming from a nebula nearby or something. And that's the cool part. Well, you know what? I don't have to rush through this. I have, you know, 6 minutes to tell this story if I have to. And that really informed my writing. It gave me a chance to write in a way I don't usually, because I normally write in a way that's informed by my DJing, where I like energy, I like fast, you know, da na na na, woo, helicopters, burn. You know, and it's this is very different, where it's like, we're going to start phasing in this new sound that's kind of like a little woo, 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 and we're just going to take 45 seconds to do that because we can, while the astronaut slowly says something about like, oh, I have a growing fear of dread. And like, it opens a lot more doors than it closes when you say, I'm going to be working with this limited palette.
Do you have any stretch goals? Were there thoughts on expanding in some other type of way?
I'm working on stretch goals right now, but I'm not in a position to actually offer as exciting stretch goals as other Kickstarters because the base product doesn't actually really benefit from economy of scale.
Right,
like
yeah.
Saying before, it's not as though if I sell another $5,000 worth of this product that I'm just pocketing that much more money. I'm also coming up with about another, 60 or 100 hours of labor.
Right, yeah.
And so I'm mostly keeping pace, which means it's not like a lot of products where once I'm screen printing the t-shirts, I can screen print 2,000 and do it just as easily and bank the rest. So every so often I can be like, hey, when we hit, 400 backers, we're going to screen print two designs of t-shirts. it won't really work like that for me. As a matter of fact, one thing that was breaking my heart was there's not really that many tiers to the Kickstarter. Basically, I've got you've got the non-unique version of the album, which is just, here, enjoy this nice album, and that's $10, same as it would be on iTunes. Then you've got the unique version, which is at $65, and then you've got a premium version at $100, which I would love to talk about in a minute, because that's kind of cool. But people were like, can there be such a thing as a two-pack? And I'm thinking, I know that it seems like it should be cool, like, hey, add a second copy for $10, but really, for me to do a two-pack, it should just be, like, paying $65 twice.
Yeah.
Each copy is a whole nother copy.
Yeah.
You won't actually see stretch goals here just yet, I think. I am trying to work on some new tracks because I do think there's maybe one or two more stories I can tell on this album. I've already explored concepts. You know, I've written a track about neutrinos that really resonates with me. I've written a track that's describing nausea of being out there, and that's a cool one. I made a track representing the fact that the astronaut's rotating and can't stop it. That's a neat one, and I might have one or two more stories to tell like that. If there's going to be a stretch goal of any kind, it's probably going to be either celebrity voiceovers, which I'm currently working on obtaining, so stay tuned, or more tracks to make the album longer.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's why some people had an issue with it, because with this, you know, concept and Kickstarter, is because as more people jump on, it literally just means more work as opposed to more funding for you to, you know, execute the project. It's just, well, now I have to spend even more time.
Yeah, no, and that's true. And the fact is that I'm not trying to do this to be my runaway 100K big payday Kickstarter. I actually don't necessarily want that because I'm not prepared to make that many copies. I am just interested in sharing this with a nice audience of people. And what's going to be really special is if this comes in at a real cool sweet spot of anywhere between where it's at now and maybe 5 to 6 times as many people as it's at now, then I think me and this select group of a couple hundred other people get this really neat, intimate experience, which is, you know, not something a lot of people have gotten to share before, especially at the $100 tier, which is where it's a unique album, but I don't hear it when I make it. So that's kind of an unprecedented thing where I'm going to be exporting a couple copies of this that I won't listen to as they're being made. And that's, I don't even know what that's going to feel like. To package up some MP3s and send them off to somebody, then delete them off my hard drive, and know that I sent some work of mine off to a person, and they have music by me to listen to, but they'll know what it sounds like, and I never will. I don't even know how I feel about that yet. And that's kind of exciting to me.
Yeah, that sounds kind of crazy. You know? Like, how would that work? Like, basically, you would just make sure everything's lined up, and then just be like, okay, it looks technically right.
So, like, when I'm – let's say that, you know, it's like I'm saying, it's time to sit down and make 400 renders of Uncertainty Principle. By the time I'm getting to number 400 and I'm like, okay, now it's time to make 5 that I don't even listen to, I've got a really good sense of how Uncertainty Principle sounds, how it works. I have faith that whatever the machines choose to do this for 400th time around will be relatively in line with the rest. And it's just kind of on a wing and a prayer. And I actually had a friend say, like, how could you not listen to a man? Won't it drive you nuts? I wouldn't be able to help it. And I said, look, if they want any – because he says, you know, you could listen and the user would never know. And I said, if you want any consolation that I won't be listening, how about that – since I'll just have heard it 400 times, I probably won't care what
right.
Like, I may have personally derived all that this track could ever hold for me personally.
Yeah. So far, I think it's really good. I've listened to all the clips you've been putting out, and it kind of reminds me of Trent Reznor, if that makes sense. Like,
I don't see how it does particularly, but I believe that it does because he's my single favorite artist, and I probably listened to more Nine Inch Nails than anyone else in my life. So I would easily believe that I'm showing his influence.
Okay, yeah, because, yeah, I'm only saying that, like, it sort of reminds me of his approach to The Social Network. It kind of has that familiarity in that sense, not in style or anything, but, like, I don't know, maybe in structure and somehow, I don't know.
I actually could see The Social Network resemblances. That's a fair comparison. I guess when you first mentioned Trent, I was thinking, you know, this doesn't sound like The Hand That Feeds or this astronaut is not interested in doing anybody like an animal situation. But actually, his album that The Social Network was based on, which is Ghosts 1 through 36, which is a 4-part album of instrumental impressionist music, I probably learned a lot from that, because if this is anything, it's an impressionist album. All the tracks are impressions.
Right. Okay.
Well, can I leave you parting with a custom render of anything for your cast? For instance, you said you've been listening to a lot of the clips I've been putting up. If you would like your own render of any of those tracks, ask away. I'll give you a promotional piece.
Oh, that'd be great. I don't even really want to choose. If you want to just pick a random one, maybe.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Man, I'll tell you what. I'll send a custom Neutrinos out your way, because I'm going to be exporting a couple Neutrinos later tonight. I need to work on that track a little. So I'll export out a custom Neutrinos, and that'll be the one that just special track for Building Better Gamers podcast.
That'd be awesome, man. I'll put it right at the end.
Excellent. Well, do you have any further questions? Or?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about things you've been doing prior to this project. How long have you been doing music?
Okay, hang on.
I know that's how long have you spent making music, I guess? Let's put it like that.
Started in seventh grade, and I'm just trying to think. I would say it's probably been, I think it's been 21 years. No, just 20. I think it's been 20 years. I started on Sonar, except at the time it was called Cakewalk 8.
Yeah.
And Reason 1.
Wow.
And then since then, I've just bought every version of Sonar since, and every version of Cakewalk since, or sorry, in Reason since, and I've just never stopped. Now I'm all the way up current, 20 years, and in that time, I wrote a symphony, a string quartet. I have 6 major releases to my name, including the Magic the Gathering album, as well as some synth pop albums, a dubstep influenced album. And then obviously on top of all that, DJing up to, let me see how many total hours of, I have to check and see how many total hours of mixes I've made now. Let's see, total minutes of audio. Oh, they don't have that stat up on Mixcloud. It says how many plays you have and how many, darn. Well, I know I have 130 episodes of Bump in the Night. They're all 60 minutes long, so that would bring me up to 7,800 minutes of DJ to listen to. You can almost listen to my DJ mixes for 2 straight weeks without stopping.
Wow, that's awesome.
If you're curious, I DJ off of a Traktor, so some DJs take their software very seriously. You've got Traktor people, you've got Serato people, you've even got virtual DJ people. I'm a tractor man. So for anyone out there who's listening, that's my team.
So, I guess to talk about your DJing is how dynamic is that job for you?
That's it's pretty dynamic. I only DJ out occasionally. It's basically one of the benefits of having lived in the same place my whole life is I've gotten to put down a lot of roots and I know people everywhere. So I basically DJ whenever I feel like it, which isn't all the time. I feel like it about once a month. I'll talk to one of the people I know who's a promoter, and I'll say, can you put me on a bill sometime in the next week? Because I'm feeling the itch to DJ. Mostly, it is just a party in my house every week. I've got some massive monitors, a couple of the newest JBLs, which are great. And I keep them mounted in a room I turned into a sound stage with the original artwork for Bump in the Night mounted right between them for inspiration while I play. And I'm just rocking it for an hour every week. And it's a lot more than that hour a week, too, because I go to a lot of effort to not repeat tracks.
Right.
When I'm doing live rips or I'm doing compilation episodes, I obviously repeat them. But when I'm just making Bump in the Night number 86 or something, I want it to be a dozen brand new tracks. So to keep the new tracks coming, I've got to listen to 40 to 60 hours of EDM every week. It's just constant. I wake up in the morning, I turn on my podcasts, and I just go all day. And I'm just taking note of every track I like that I hear. Just to make sure that I can come up with, 12 new ones to spin the next week that will all mix. So it's a lot of fun. It keeps me going. It keeps me dancing. A lot of weeks, it's the most fun I'll have all week because I just rage even just alone in my room. That's the sound room.
So like DJing's not something you would want to do full time, or?
Oh, it's something I could do. It's something I could do full time. One day, if I don't work as a programmer anymore, maybe I would start doing it all the time. I'm very lucky. I think I'm very blessed, or whatever you want to call it, that I'm in a really good spot where I can do these things on a as I like them basis and not as I have to basis.
Yeah.
So I'm in a good place where my work is nice, and so DJing is something I do whenever I feel the pull. And that keeps it fun and never like work. Is there a future? Especially because I work at a startup, so I may find myself out of work sometime in the next year just because that's startup life. It can always happen. If something like that happens, am I going to keep working as a dev or start thinking about maybe just DJing all the time? Sure, but then, I'll probably start doing is just programming in my spare time because it's like, oh, it's nice to program. It's a hobby.
Yeah.
Whichever thing isn't the work, right?
Right, right. That's cool, though. That's great.
Are you a musician at all?
I've been involved in music for a long time, like since elementary school. I've been playing instruments and stuff.
Are you a multi-instrumentalist?
I would consider myself that, kinda, right now. I mean, I don't really have access to everything like I used to, but I still can do some keyboard stuff. I have a lot of experience with horns.
So, oh, that's nice. My wife is a multi-instrumentalist. She can play two different ukuleles, guitar, piano, and a marimba.
That's cool.
Quite a treat having her around the house. One thing people might not know about me is that despite having recorded 7 albums now, soon to be 700, I guess.
I
don't really play any instruments very well. I can play every instrument well enough to get one good take out of it. So I can always play the guitar well enough to record a guitar part for a song, if it takes me, you know, 50 tries, I'll just take the 50th. Same with the bass, same with the keyboard, but actually can't play anything fluently. And I'm a bit sad, but there'll be time to learn that later, maybe.
Okay. So, because this podcast is focused on gamers a lot, where has gaming influenced your taste in music and how you want to approach music?
Oh, well, I mean, somewhat. I mean, first off, gaming was, it's the entire reason for the existence of The Gathering, you know, with Patrick Chapin. That was just a great experience. Like, I've played Magic since 94. I've been playing Magic, you know, just the whole time, longer than I've done anything else in my life. As a matter of fact, I just got some ink the other day. I got the mana symbols all on my chest.
That's cool.
Yeah, I just realized, like, look, since this point, like, every positive interaction I've had for most of my adult life has been through Magic. It's how I met all my friends. It's what I've done every Friday for the longest time. It's what I do with my wife. It's just, you know, Magic is everything around me. And so that was great, making The Gathering with Patrick and just bringing, trying to tell stories about this game we love and have played for so long, you know, him even longer than me. You know, I'm still playing it to this day. I was just at FNM this past Friday. I went 3-1 in Modern with Abzan. games, you know, games are everything. It's, there's three things that are me, and it's music, programming, and games. And now that we're talking about games, that's kind of like the third pillar. And I'm sure you know what that feels like too.
Yeah. Yeah, what makes it kind of funny to tie it back in is with games, people can create their own path and have their own means to the end, and you're actually doing that with your new project. You know, you're giving people their own individual experience that can be, you know, compared to everyone else's because you're using similar parts, but, you know, everyone can have their own point of view.
In that sense, although now you got my head spinning, thinking of ways that, you know, an album could be more like a video game. Like, oh, how could you, like, play the album with a controller? Don't get me.
That sounds like the next Kickstarter.
Yeah. although by the time this is all done, I'll be relieved to maybe write some normal music. I worked on a song the other day that was a song that only went one way. It was just a song that went a certain way, and I recorded it once. And I was like, oh, that was nice. Not get used to that, because that's not going to happen for a little while. but other games, man, I play I used to play more video games than I do now. I like Hearthstone a lot. Me and my partner play a lot of Hearthstone. I really like, on the tabletop, I'm a big fan of Takenoko. I could play Takenoko all day. I like Euro-style board games. I like Puerto Rico. I like San Juan. What are some of your favorites?
Some of my favorites? Right now I am getting back into the Versus system because they just re-released it as a living card game.
Oh, I played that when it first came out as a non-living card game. It had its charms. It was fun. What's the re-release like?
It's pretty cool. I enjoy it. What they did was now it's kind of like Commander versus system, you know, where now is you have this one main character that you both start off with, and the objective of the game is to kill off that main character.
Is it still a Marvel property, a DC property, or both?
They're actually going to go through all the properties at some point. Now, they just did a Marvel set. So you get, like, villains, Avengers, Guardians of the Galaxy, X-Men. I think that's it. Like, you just get, you know, a bunch of those type of different characters for now.
Cool. Oh, that does sound like fun. I got Netrunner here, and I got to bust that out. I always have a hard time playing the living card games with someone else because it's like, do you just build your decks to beat each other? It's hard outside of a tournament environment.
Right, yeah. I've been wanting to get into Netrunner. I
played the original Netrunner back in 96 or whenever it came out, and I always thought that was one of the best designed games ever.
Yeah.
Well, it's asymmetrical, and asymmetrical games are just their whole own sort of school of design. Like, how do you design a good asymmetrical game? And that game did a great job by sort of giving it set up so that it seems like the corp is truly the control.
Right, yeah.
It's truly the aggro, because it's just so natural. Like, the runner is the one who has to attack, and the corp is the one who has to defend against those attacks. But then there's all these subways in which all the roles are differently flipped. Like, when it comes to putting tags on the runner to find them in real life so you can literally just blow their head off instead of having to go through the net, the corporation takes the initiative and the runner's on the defense. And so there's all these little battles being fought asymmetrically. And that's what I just think makes it a great game.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. It just feels like it's a lot to catch up on. That's why I haven't really gotten into the living, to like this new set of cards. So,
Do you play Tiny Leaders at all?
I'm thinking about building one. I'm thinking about building a deck.
Here, my wife is Verals the Scar Striped, who...
Ooh, that's nice, yeah.
Busted. I mean, just play Death's Shadow or Phyrexian Dreadnought for one mana. It helps itself to the graveyard, and bam. Here is swinging for 16. I'm Zozu the Punisher, my mono red burn deck. Hmm. That's fun too.
Okay.
Yep, it just gets in there and gets the job done fast.
Yeah, I guess you could say I kind of just got into EDH. I just built quite a few decks right now. I have a Talrand. Talrand is like my main focus. I like the idea that it's like just blue, but it's also really aggressive.
How are you orienting it? Like, are you building it specifically to thrive in multiplayer, or are you building it to be better for one-on-one?
I'm most likely I'm going to be using it for multiplayer.
Okay.
So, but I do try to keep it as, I guess you could say, fair as possible. I'm not running anything too crazy.
No, oh my God, what is it? Time Walk with Is It Kronark and Dead Eye.
Right, yeah, stuff like that, or like, I'm not trying to, is it Sunder? Like, bounce all the lands back. I'm not trying to do any of that, like, anything too crazy.
I could never help myself, like, I could never hold back, because I just couldn't bring myself to build suboptimally. So
yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. I've been competitive for a very long time.
Why am I not playing Is It Kronark with Time Walk in this deck? Like, why shouldn't I? And the thing that helps me there is deliberately placing like a restriction, once again, because restrictions breed creativity, where it's like, all right, look, this deck is only going to win one way. And then I'm just going to make it the best deck it can be at winning that way. And then I'll be ruthless in the pursuit of that goal.
Right.
But the goal might be, what is it for my one deck? Gaining infinite life with Sanguine Bond in play.
Wow.
So, as an example. Yeah. So it's like the rest of the deck is busted, but only at assembling that combo.
Yeah, in that specific way.
Right. I have a friend who built one I really liked where he built a Mardu colored deck that the only way it allowed itself to win was with mass damage that it would itself outlive. So that was like his restriction was he would Earthquake and Havoc Festival and Exsanguinate and roll all the things that deal X damage to every player and or X damage to every opponent, etc. And he would play it so that you would just play the whole game, everyone's at 40, everyone's at 40 or something, and he would get like both people a life point lower than him and be like, all right, everyone's taking 39. And you know what the MVP of that deck was? It was Repay in Kind, which I won't be mad if you don't know what it is.
I don't.
It's a 7-mana black sorcery from, let's see, Rise of the Eldrazi.
Wow.
All players' life totals become equal to the lowest life total.
Wow.
And so what you would always do is you would, we would always be like, you have to kill Eric because he's going to do that thing where he just fries the whole table and makes it a draw again.
Yeah,
and it's like, okay, so you start attacking him. You get him down to 4, and he's like, all right, Repay in Kind. Now everyone's at 4. Comet Storm, you two.
That's crazy.
That's a lot of fun. So what kind of – do you have interesting win conditions or unusual things near Talrand?
My Talrand, probably not. I think what I am doing is I am basically – I've set it up to where it's just – I cycle through the deck extremely fast, probably faster than it normally should. So I do have to worry about decking myself.
Are you just like mental note, delve that away,
yeah,
from the cruise, dig through time, brainstorm, shuffle?
Right, yeah. It's a lot of that stuff going on there. And so that is, but the thing is, I haven't really thought about putting something in to like try to get those cards back. But at this point, I'm not really too worried about that. I like the idea of, you know what, I better make sure I win this game or I deck myself out.
You know, there's something to be said for the fact that we've learned about card advantage for so long in Magic that drawing cards is kind of intrinsically fun, even if it doesn't go anywhere. Like, and I'm super prone to this in Cube, where I'm like, ooh, I just drew 2 cards. Hey, I'm going to draw another card. Like, this is great. My deck is so good. I'm drawing another card. Meanwhile, my opponent has, like, creatures, and all the stuff I'm drawing is just more ramp or whatever. Nothing does anything. It's just more card draw. But I'm like, I feel so good. I'm clearly winning. Look at all these cards I drew.
Yeah, it's like, I have more access to more stuff. And, it's...
They never had that in Versus system. In Versus system, cards were cheap. What was expensive was setting up for Trample, right? I'm trying to remember, like, cards, there was tons of them, but what was, like, you spent all your effort doing was, like, setting up attacks that would actually trample over for, like, a ton.
Yeah. They've basically gotten rid of that.
What's it about then?
I mean, basically, it's all about those main characters and then trying to support them and killing the other main character. That's really what it's about now.
All right.
And the main characters, what they do is they have abilities that if you succeed in performing something, they get experience points. And when they get enough experience points, they level up. And, when they level up, their superpowers are even better than they were before. Like, I'm trying to create a good example.
Well, who do you play? Who's your hero when you play?
Right now, I really like Deadpool.
Okay.
but that's because his level 2 ability is a alt win condition, basically. Where what happens is, when he reaches level 2... your opponent actually turns into a character that ends up on the board. And he's like, it's not even a good character. It's just a 0-1 character. And so, so you could just easily just kill that character and you win the game.
Is that supposed to be like a reference to how Deadpool always breaks the fourth wall?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's basically his abilities are where, like, when you kill everybody, he levels up when everyone is stunned. So, okay. And that ability is called Where Did Everyone Go? And then when you level him up, that ability that turns your opponent into a character is, oh, I see one.
Okay. So, I see one. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. It's pretty good. It's that's one I like. I mean, they're all fairly solid. The game's just, you know, people are just starting to get a hang of it. At first, people were a little worried that it wasn't that balanced, but it's coming out pretty good. And also, we don't have to wait that long for an expansion. They said one's coming out in January. So,
Well, I may have to try that. Would it be a good couples game, do you think? Because most of my gaming is just me and my spouse just chilling. I really like games that are for two player.
Yeah, they actually sell it as a two player game. That's what they call it. They call it a two player game now.
But like, would it work really well in that sense where we could both build decks and play them against each other, or would we just both like be metagaming against each other?
No, I don't think you have to worry about that. I think you both can play, especially if you guys try to stay within like the tribes, sort of. That'll actually give you guys access to enough cards and stuff. Because
good, as long as we wouldn't just both be fighting. Like, no, I want the time walk in my deck. No, I want it in mine.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about that. Yeah.
Cool. Because one thing that I have a hard time with is we love board games, but so many of the best ones, the most deepest strategic ones, like, you know, your, I don't want to say your Catan, but your ones that have a lot of, like, moving parts, like Agricola and Tzolk'in or Puerto Rico and stuff, they're always built where a lot, since they don't have dice and they don't have, random stuff, the randomness comes from, like, the unpredictableness of having three or four people. And they just don't play with two. Or if they do, then it's, like, a solvable game. Because it's, like, tic-tac-toe. Right. Where you're only trying to deal... Like, what are you going to do in Catan two-player, right? Trade with the other person? It's going to be a bad trade for someone.
Yeah.
And so we're always looking for good two-player games. Actually, you want to pitch one that... is like this tiny printed, it's practically a play in print. I want to find it real quick. There's this game called Time Barons by the Game Crafter that looks so simple. It's a two-player game that's balanced for two players that's directly based on, like, attacking each other back and forth. You get three actions a turn. You're almost always one action short of being able to kill your opponent and one action ahead of where they could kill you. And it's just brilliantly done. We've probably played 100 games of Time Barons. So shout out to Time Barons. Google search it. It looks weak, but you'd be surprised.
That's interesting. Yeah, the only other two-player card game I really have is one called Yomi, and it's a representation of a fighting game, but as a card game.
Okay. Yomi is a fighting game, and oh, it's on Steam.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also there. It's also online.
Well, that's kind of cool. Maybe I'll try it on, oh, wow. Yeah. Hey, purchasable, not like another free-to-play product where I'm going to be finding cards in this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's none of that mess. The decks themselves actually represent a regular deck of cards.
Okay, and on the wish list it goes.
Yeah, I have the first edition of the actual cards themselves. They're really nice, really. It's a really fun game and lots of interesting characters, and he's still working on it.
Awesome. All right, that one's on the wish list. gosh, that's I love going on podcast tours with gamers. Yeah, I'm doing a lot of podcasts to promote this Kickstarter, right? But when I'm with gamers, after we're done talking shop, it's down to just talking about the stuff that we're really both passionate about. And on other casts, it's sometimes like, so yeah, what else do you like? I don't know, journalism? No, it's like, we're here for the same reason. I could talk about games all night. God, what else is, you know, I really like Takenoko for two. Takenoko being the adorable panda game, the panda garden game.
Okay.
I also really like Hanabi a lot. Have you played Hanabi?
I've heard of it. I've not played it yet.
So it's a co-op game for between like two and four people where you're holding your hand outward. You can't see it. The other people can. And there, you have a limited amount of clues to work with. There's a shared pool of clues between both people, and you can spend a clue to give a person a very specific piece of information about their hand. You can't tell them what a card is, but you can tell them how many cards they have of a certain suit or a certain number. So you could say, for instance, you have exactly three blues, and they're this card, and this card. And once you run out of the clues after that phase, you've got to take turns playing out all the cards in each suit in the right order. So between the two of you, like, I'll play the one, I'll play the two, you'll play the three, I'll play the four, and you're playing them blind out of your hand, not knowing which ones were where. And it's an amazing game for couples or just friends, because you have to develop this new language together out of this very limited skill set. There's not enough information to tell people what all the cards in their hand are. So you have to use this limited amount of information and be like, I wonder if they'll infer by the fact that I'm telling them they only have one yellow, that they understand it means it's time to play that yellow, or that they should wait to play it. And it's cool. There's a lot of, like, communication implicitly. I really like that.
That's interesting. Huh? I like the idea of that.
I actually saw, I think it was PV... But, you know, Paulo Vitor.
Yeah.
He was tweeting one day, if it wasn't him, it was another pro, saying, I'm really impressed with Hanabi. I played it all night with, like, the three other smartest, like, literal people I know in the world, like, all pros, and we still couldn't decide on what the right way to play it is.
Wow.
Wow.
Yep, I've only ever won it twice. It's impossible to do it right. Twice we've done the whole perfect score. What else you play? Or is that really all of it lately? The versus?
That's been a majority of it, really. I'm kind of just, other than that, I've just really just been chilling, you know, just waiting on other things to happen.
Awesome. All right. Well, do you have anything else?
No, that's really it, man. If there's anything else you want to put out there, you know, feel free.
Oh, no, I'm just, if anyone wants to find me, I'm on Twitter at Spruik. I'm on Facebook as Spruik, YouTube Spruik, Instagram Spruik, SoundCloud and Mixcloud Spruik. The Kickstarter is called Music to Die Alone in Space 2, and it's the album that tells the story of an astronaut who's marooned alone in space and running out of air, but more importantly, it is the first ever album that's going to be reproduced in a new unique copy for every person who purchases it. So you can check that out on Kickstarter just by searching for Music to Die Alone in Space 2. It's currently their featured music project. Other than that, thanks for having me, Charles. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I'm really looking forward to seeing how you managed to pull this off.
Yeah, me too, honestly. This is exciting. Now I'm going to go make a copy of Neutrinos for your cast.
All right, sounds good. And then they're going to hear it right after this. Thank you.